Welcome to the Commentary Magazine Podcast. Today is Wednesday, June 13th, 2018. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-some-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at CommentaryMagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, ask you to subscribe, $19.95 digital subscription, $29.95 all-access subscription, including, yes, our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. We are closing our July-August, our 11th issue of the year, our double issue, right now, today. Got fantastic stuff in it. We'll try to fill you in on the fantastic stuff on Monday, because I don't think we're going to have it up online until then. Maybe, Abe, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Monday is
it. Okay, yeah. So it's great stuff. It's a huge issue, 80 pages, one of the biggest issues we've done in years. So much good stuff, your head will spin. And the person who is shepherding it into print, sitting right across from me, senior editor Abe Greenwald. How are you, Abe?
I'm doing well. Hi, John.
Oh, good. And Noah Rothman, associate editor, wearing a tie in our hot studio. How you doing, Noah?
I'm super.
And thinking that he needs a new voice because he didn't like the way he sounded on a previous podcast, senior writer Saurabh Amari.
Hi, John.
Did that sound like a different voice? If people think that Saurabh needs a different voice, please tweet at him and tell him not to change his voice because he's got a perfectly good voice. Okay, so I'm going to start positing about the Singapore summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un. I'm gonna lay this out, and then I'm going to be attacked by my colleagues. I'm laying this out. I'm not saying I agree with this. I'm just going to lay it out. So they had a summit, and they came out, and what came out of it was a communique that says very little. And so Trump has said that the threat of nuclear war from North Korea is gone. He said that on Twitter this morning. Sleep soundly, everybody. No more nuclear threat. And Kim, or the regime, seems to have said that they got some guarantee that the Korean Peninsula would be denuclearized in their understanding, which means a full pullout of U.S. forces from the peninsula. Everybody, there were smiles, there were handshakes and everything like that. And basically, this means nothing. What it means is the optics of them meeting. What it means is that Trump has now personalized diplomacy in a new way. It doesn't mean nothing, but nothing was done that is binding, and nothing really, in the absence of real significant change on the part of the North Koreans that is verifiable and visible and noticeable, the United States is committed to nothing and no change. And even though Trump himself said that he would suspend war games with South Korea next year because they're expensive, he called them war games as opposed to military exercises. He doesn't have to because they aren't going to happen for another, I think, 9 or 10 months. And so if things with the North Koreans go south, we can always do them anyway. It's not like he's canceled any that are, you know, imminent. So that would be my opening gambit here. Is it looked like a big deal. It's actually a big nothing burger. Abe, now you tell me why it is not a nothing burger. In fact, I believe you said that in some ways things were done here that represent the worst things that may ever have happened in an American presidency.
I think that's true, and I think it has to do with what Donald Trump said. By the way, saying calling our military exercises with South Korea war games is the least offensive thing he said. In fact, I would, as a sort of hawk, I would like to reclaim war games as a positive American thing. I think we should call them war games. I would really say there are two awful, unforgivable, shameful, importantly dangerous things that happened yesterday, and they're related. One is the elevation of Kim Jong-un, the worst dictator on the planet, putting him on the same plane as the leader of the free world. That is a horrible precedent. It is a horrible reality. It is a dangerous trophy for Kim to take back home. The other and related problem here is that the atrocious way that Trump praised this man, and the inverse of reality, of the brutal reality that was required for him to do it. He said he trusts Kim. He said Kim cares about his people. His people love him.
His people.
Right. Yeah, this, he talked about this, essentially the mutual love between Kim and his people. This is a disgusting moral transgression in and of itself. It also contributes to what is usually called under more traditional American administrations are a credibility gap in which American leaders speak beautifully and eloquently and passionately about human rights around the world, and then on occasion, out of necessity, engage in a sort of realpolitik that requires our dealing with human rights abusers and whatnot.
When I think it's important, when did Trump himself do this just in the past year?
At his State of the Union address, he made an extensive theatrical and sort of unusually eloquent case against the brutality and horrors of the North Korean regime, detail showcasing people who have been really mangled by that police state. And he spoke. He went on at length, at extraordinary length, actually, during the State of the Union address about what an atrocious human rights abusing regime in North Korea was. And now he turns around and says, Kim loves his people.
5 months later,
his people love him. This is one of those things that will go in the archives justifiably. Of those people who say the United States doesn't really care about human rights. They talk a big game, but when it comes down to it, they just do what's in their interest. So I don't believe when the neocons talk about spreading freedom. This hurts the good cause, and it is an outlier, by the way. I mean, the case is often made that the U.S. does this. I think that the case that's made against the U.S. on those terms is very unfair. The U.S. has historically had to do what it sort of has to do within certain limits, but still tries to always work toward freedom and democracy within those limits. This is sort of stepped out of that. As Trump has stepped out of those bounds and completely reversed himself.
Okay, may I just very briefly highlight the most grotesque of the his remarks, which was there was a meal after the summitry where they were sitting side by side, and at the beginning the reporters had access. And President Trump turned to the camera and said, "Are you all going to shoot a nice photograph so we can look handsome and thin?" And Kim Jong-un was sitting across from him. And first of all, just the vulgarity, the narcissism, all of that aside, as I remarked on Twitter, Kim's people happen to know something about being thin because he systematically starves them. And I mean, there were many others, but that one for some reason just...
Okay, so devil's advocate. Abe... Noah hasn't even spoken yet. We're going to get to Noah's eloquent assault in a second. But you guys, do you hate Trump so much that you can't even root for the lowering of a threat of nuclear war and the possibility that he sees what you don't see and understands somebody like him in a way that you don't understand, that the flattery is all part of a strategy to achieve an end that no president could have achieved before? Is your never Trumpism so toxic that you cannot see the genius of what has gone on here?
I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank
you. Because that is I have been getting that kind of response on social media to my objections to what happened yesterday. And of course, I have been anything but hesitant to praise Trump where I feel praise is due. I'm relieved when he does things I like, and therefore I am vocal about it. Especially because I've grown tired of the impulse to put down every last thing he does, even if it is in accordance with one's own principles before he became president. So no, not at all. He did something exceptionally disgusting. Okay.
I respect our audience too much to believe that trite, emotionally manipulative appeals to cults of personality sway them. I think they like substance and foresight and insight, and they would reject your appeal outright because it belongs, as Abe said, in tawdry corners of social media where that sort of thing plays.
So, flattery will get you everywhere, Noah. You're just following the Trump playbook with Kim. You're flattering the Commentary Magazine podcast audience. And I'm going to say it may work.
I hope so.
And, you know, that's what I'm saying. Maybe Trump knows that the flattery will get you everywhere when you're talking to a Kim, though I don't really think that that's what history suggests about this regime, which really does appear to have swallowed whole the Machiavellian axiom that it is better to be feared than loved. That is the nature of that regime's 70, you know, almost 70-year hold on the people who live in its, you know, in this open air prison.
Okay, at the risk of repeating,
now, please.
Yeah, so I'm going to monologize a little bit here. At the risk of repeating, Abe, I want to lay out all the reasons why what happened on Monday was an unmitigated disaster, and there is no upside. First, the agreement to which both parties were privy simply doesn't exist. It is a statement of principles that is weaker than what we saw in 2005 at the end of the six-party nuclear talks, which resulted in, as we know, failure. The language that was used was vague enough so that DPRK has been playing the definition games that it always plays and is now claiming, as of an hour ago, that the United States agreed to denuclearize too, because who knows? None of it's written down. The president, at the end of a three-month preparatory process in which the summit is supposed to be a formality, got nothing. In fact, the summit was called off at some point because the negotiations beforehand were going so poorly. They managed only at the very last minute to secure a promise on written is good on the paper it's written on, which is to say it's not, to dismantle one engine testing site for ballistic missiles. There's no language about denuclearization, not even a shared definition. There's no timeline. There's no agreement to meet again. There's no verification regime. There isn't even a disclosure about an existing nuclear program, facilities, bombs, nothing. It doesn't exist. It was simply a show for the coming out party that was the Kim Jong-un legitimization fest. And why is that bad? Tangible results of why you don't legitimize a monster like this guy, because it strengthens his domestic position. We know that Kim has purged the security apparatus of people who might plausibly be a threat to his legitimacy. We know that the regime has been strengthened as a result. We know now that they're showing pictures in North Korean media, two regular North Korean citizens, of Kim taking his little stroll along the banks of a rivers in Singapore, showing the North Korean people what a fully developed, modernized, industrialized Asian country looks like at night, all lit up, which is something that Koreans don't normally see. Now, that might weaken the regime's hold on these people because they might look at the outside world and say, well, gosh, that looks like something we might want. But they all have access to black market thumb drives and little computers where they watch Chinese television and South Korean television on, so they've seen the outside world. That suggests to me that this regime is really very secure in its hold over these people. Finally, the notion that these, you know, calling them war games and provocative is again a ratification of this language that is used by the DPRK and is kind of acceptable. And the fact that we haven't brought up any human rights abuses at all over the course of this showing ratifies Barack Obama's approach to foreign policy. He buried under this mountain of rationalizations, this sort of realist approach to international relations with foreign powers that were maybe unsavory, and with the assumption that the opening them up to the global economy, the magic of globalization, would force domestic liberalization on these regimes, and the precise opposite has happened. In fact, more abuses has followed, more crackdowns on dissidents have followed as the regime becomes more secure in its position, and that is precisely what we're going to see. A crackdown on dissidents in North Korea, more abuses at home, even this regime could be more abusive. 200,000 people are in prison, including families and whole families, including three generations of families, because they have to punish generations who haven't even committed crimes as a result. And if history is any predicate, we will see provocations, because the cessation of military drills came as a surprise to ROK. Republic of Korea said, we didn't see this one coming. And ROK and DPRK have this little dance where anytime there's daylight between Seoul and Washington, North Korea exploits it. So we're going to see a provocation, and it could be a military provocation. That's not beyond the realm of plausibility either. The shelling of an island, an attack on a ship, something to test these new parameters, because the game has changed, and when the terms of the game changes, DPRK does what it normally does, which is to see what its new position is. And I expect we're going to see that, and that's very dangerous. People could die.
Okay. So let me then lay this out. People could die. So what? People will die. People die every day. Countries do terrible things. The Trump worldview is it's not America's job to make sure that people don't die on the Korean Peninsula. It's his job to put America first, MAGA, wear the hat, get into trade wars to help us. All we care about with North Korea really is that it doesn't shoot a nuclear weapon at us. Maybe we care that it doesn't shoot a nuclear weapon at other people, but we don't care that much about it. So all your crying crocodile, you're trying bitter tears about the threats to the South and destabilization. Well, that's not our game anymore. That's not the country we're living in anymore. That's not the presidency that we have. We got a president who puts America first, doesn't, and you know what? That means he doesn't care about the North Korea. Yeah, okay, fine. He doesn't care about the North Koreans. Or, you know, how do you know? How do you know that he looked into Kim's? He likes him, and Kim may build condos. It's got great beachfront property. He'll build condos. Trump will talk him into going capitalist. It'll be fantastic. How do you know? So, Saurabh, riddle me that.
I would just say, look, the world that we've lived in for the past 60, 70, 80 years, although Abe, Noah, and I, and John, he's not 80 years old. But the
I'm
world,
almost 80.
The world that
I'm
we...
I'm closer to 80 than any of you guys are. Let me just put it that way.
Right. But that world has been in place, and it's been relatively safe because we don't just say, well, let nations do this and that, because when that happened in the first half of the 20th century, when America was this engaged, you had this orgy of bloodletting on both ends of the earth that ended in 1945. And we built a system of alliances in which certain powers that were generally democratic, though not necessarily always, could rely on us for their security, and they could have this peace of mind and not feel like they all need to aggressively defend every inch of their interests because they had this sort of global big brother. It had its flaws. The system occasionally called for conflicts, so on and so forth. But on the whole, that's the world that we've inherited. And before we start thinking, well, if Japan has to defend itself, so be it. If Japan has to develop nuclear weapons, so be it. If South Korea has to do that, so be it. If Saudi Arabia has to do that, so be it. Just, you know, just to recall that the world that we live in is not a historical inevitability. It's a contingent result of generations of policymaking. And the world that we could inherit after all this may not be so pleasant. It may require, for example, the military sacrifice of many more Americans than has been required so far.
Okay, so that is the, you know, liberal
argument.
Internationalist, you liberals and your internationalism, and it's all fine. But you know what I see wearing my MAGA hat right now? Here's what I see. I see a whole world in which we saved everybody, and now they're screwing us in trade deals. And South Korea, they're such a friend. What about their tariffs? What about their car tariffs? And, you know, sure, you know, Trump left the G7 getting insulted by Justin Trudeau, but gets a hearty handshake of good fellowship from Kim Jong-un. Who's his better friend? Justin Trudeau, the whelp of Canada, or Kim Jong-un, the man you can trust, a guy he trusts? He looked into his eyes. He knew in a minute that they had a deal
going. I think you're playing
a very
subversive game here, because you've painted the MAGA hat wearer as somebody who has very little attachment to policy and is purely navigating the world through the eyes of someone who wants to see effrontery against Donald Trump, the man, punished. That couldn't be the MAGA hat wearing average Trump supporting citizen.
No, but this
they
is
surely
America.
Have more critical thinking powers than that.
What I am trying to characterize, I think, is the growing acceptance of a worldview that I think we can say is distinctively Trumpian, that the post-war world order was good for us until about 1970, and now it's then it got unfair. And beginning in the 80s, we made bad deals, and everything got terrible. And so what? That we, you know, our economy is four times the size that it was in 1980. Big deal, because you know everyone's left behind. And da, da, da. Now I want to make it clear, as I'm sure people understand, I do not believe a word of almost anything that I've just said on this podcast thus far. I do think that this worldview is gaining purchase, and we will talk about why and the signs of its gaining purchase after I recommend to you on this podcast that if you like this podcast, we have another show, another podcast you might enjoy, IsraelCast, from the Jewish National Fund. This podcast brings you fascinating people doing interesting work all over Israel, as well as Israelis making their mark in the U.S., from Spice Master Lior Sokaz of La Boite NYC to Ambassador Ido Aharoni, from Queen of Kosher Jamie Geller to former Miss Israel Titi Eno. There is a topic for every interest on IsraelCast. Find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts today, and we thank the Jewish National Fund for sponsoring the Commentary Podcast. So, in 2016, throughout the primaries, first, Trump could only capture about 25% of the Republican vote. By the time he was done, he was capturing an aggregate about 45% of the Republican vote. That's what he got.
Yeah, it was,
when
Cruz and Kasich were the only opponents.
Right. So basically, he ended up with an aggregate of about 45% of the Republican vote, which was why there was this delusion that maybe he could be prevented from getting, you know, a first ballot victory at the Republican National Convention, if you remember, from about 2 years ago this time. So here we are now. He wins the presidency. The Republican Party has the House and the Senate. And he has anywhere between 80 and 95% support among Republicans. It's hard to tell because different polls ask questions in different ways. His polling is around 42-43%, so that's really good for him. It's not necessarily historically good, but good for him. But he has this strong support in the Republican Party. And last night in primary in South Carolina, one of the most principled, semi-old-fashioned Republicans, I'd say a real green eyeshade-wearing deficit hawk, former Governor Mark Sanford, member of the House, for 4 years. Basically, he lost. He was defeated in a primary by a former Republican regular who now became the Trumpy candidate in the race, because Sanford has called into question Trump's budget busting and his character. Now, Sanford, you may say, is a person who really shouldn't be going around talking about anybody else's character. You know, he had to resign, I believe, from the governorship. I can't remember. Anyway, he ruined his governorship because he went off and had an affair. And his wife, you know, said his press secretary said he was walking the Appalachian Trail, you may remember, and then his wife threw his clothing out of the house, and so that was it. And so, and then he even ended up breaking up with the woman that he loved from Argentina. So it's very sad. But then he ended up getting back into the house, and he just lost a primary, and nobody. And so, in some ways, Sanford was a model of a Republican of a sort that barely exists anymore, which is that he's consumed with worry. He's philosophically opposed to government spending. He is consumed with worry about the deficit, the debt, the looming entitlements crisis, everything like that. He believes that government spending is also saps national will and erodes individual purpose and all of that. And so he is basically now gone. And, just as Senator Bob Corker is gone, and Senator Jeff Flake is gone, and who else in the anti-Trump Republican political
Speaker
camp
of the House?
But he's not anti. He was not.
None of them were overtly anti-Trump until they retired.
Well, Flake was.
Well, Flake was.
Flake certainly was, and Corker said, you know, it's like a daycare
but
center.
Sanford's not anti-Trump. I mean, okay, so
basically, two senators and a leading congressman Now, the senators were tired rather than being defeated in primaries. The congressman has been defeated by somebody that Trump then tweeted out at 5 o'clock yesterday, just as the polls were closing, he wanted you to vote for, although I think she won a commanding enough victory that she didn't need the tweet to push her over the top. So what is this? So the internationalism that is being superseded by Trumpism, how is it ever going to get purchased again?
So to my mind, you've articulated two separate things. First, before the break, you said that this sort of retrenchment philosophy that says, you know, who cares if a bunch of South Koreans get killed as long as Americans are fine, Japan, what have you. That to me is a sort of strain of isolationism that is more American than anything around this table. That is the status quo. Americans have always had a healthy aversion towards European foreign affairs and a belief that the two oceans would protect them, and has been an introverted nation. And that is, frankly, a good thing. We shouldn't be desirous of having a United States that is too extroverted, because it means that the world needs a United States.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't agree with you. Yeah, if that's what you're about to say. I mean, I think the interesting thing is, I think America has always sort of spoken that way, and then can be roused predictably to action under the right circumstances,
and not least because the two oceans didn't protect us.
Yeah, right? But I think if you polled over the course of the last 70 years how people felt about the named alliances of the United States, about NATO, for example, it would have been positive. People have positive views of European countries. People had negative views of our, and believed that we needed to be engaged in the Cold War, supported until the war went south, supported the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And remember, the first libertarian isolationist moment of this decade, around 2012, 2013, when everyone thought, oh, you know who's going to be the next president? Rand Paul. He's so interesting. He's a libertarian. He doesn't believe in the war. He's look how everyone's turning against everything.
It's over, that moment.
And then... No, but then it's over, and then it came back. That's what I'm saying. But then we saw two videos of two beheadings of two Americans by ISIS, and the idea that we needed to go to war in the Middle East to destroy ISIS flipped from 30% support to 65% support for two people.
Yeah.
So I don't think that the American America is naturally isolationist. I think that having a leader who is an isolationist – or Trump's not. I mean,
an isolationist, right, in the Rand Paulian sense, though. It's a sort of
not at all, because he's not philosophically isolationist.
He's not philosophically isolationist. He's not a libertarian, because
not at all.
Rand Paul comes from the strand that is kind of the worst strand of American thought. This mixture of extreme individualism, libertarianism that says trade and contract could solve everything. You know, extreme libertarians think the Civil War didn't need to be fought. It could have been. I have no idea
I just want to say, I don't think that we're exceptionally interventionist necessarily either. I think the both strains of foreign policy thought have always existed in our makeup, and it's an ongoing debate about whether we are sort of an empire of democracy, as I think Jefferson put it, or if we are just a sort of well-wishers from afar, as I think.
Well, I suppose you could debate it, but I think I still maintain that the United States is politically more introverted than extroverted as a natural sort of state of affairs, but you could debate that. What we can't debate is the notion that this sort of populist cult of personality that defines Trumpism today is the natural state of affairs. That is an aberration. That is unique and new, and that's part of the reason why I don't think it's a especially long-lived, although I'm the only person around this table who seems to think that, is because
you sort of had it with Jackson.
Well, you have to go back two centuries to find a personality cult that's suspected. It's not duplicable. It is one that has, for example, Mark Sanford gets bounced from his primary because he was mean to Trump. He said that Trump had exacerbated the political situation, that he had made the likelihood of political violence worse. Not the fact that he was a member of the Freedom Caucus in good standing, a member of a political faction in Congress that resents and resists every possible concession to Democrats on the issue of immigration. Not about policy, about the personal effrontery towards Donald Trump. And because Donald Trump's policy positions are so fluid, that's how the public navigates this thing. They don't know what Donald Trump stands for in a day-to-day basis. They do know when he's insulted. And that's the extent to which they are able to navigate a very confusing political situation. And that lasts only as long as Donald Trump is behind the Oval Office, behind the Resolute Desk.
Okay. If Donald Trump is president for another 6 years, the idea that he will leave no, you know, lasting mark on his party or his country or the way in which the world is viewed by the United States is, I think, prima facie wrong. I mean, we don't know how that will happen, and we don't know. Presidencies always start disaffecting people in their last couple of years, so there's often a reaction, like Obama to Bush and Trump to Obama. But of course he's going to have a long-lasting effect, even if it's a cult of personality, because people will codify or attempt to codify how the views that he expresses that gain purchase, you know, might be spoken of by somebody else. So that's why when I lay this out and I said to you what I said, there is a mindset that will that does connect the why people aren't going to feel that what Trump said about Kim is shameful with the hawkishness on trade, which is Trump can say and do whatever he wants in the way that he does because he doesn't care about liberal opinion. He doesn't care about how the world views the United States and if it likes it or it doesn't like it. He wants America to win. He's against all of this stuff that restrains us if we need restraint. He doesn't care about the people of other countries. He cares about Americans. Now, I really hope that this is not the direction in which the Republican Party goes or that it's easy for it to snap back. It's pinched. It's parched. It's wrong. It is a denial of a core root fact about the United States, what we used to call American exceptionalism. And not American exceptionalism because what we do is we care more about ourselves than everybody else, because American exceptionalism says that people connect to America on the basis of ideas about liberty and freedom and not because we just happen to have been born here as an accident of birth. Like, you can be an American in your soul if you were born in Mali, if liberty sings in your spirit and you want to participate in all the benefits of ordered liberty in the United States, that's makes you an American even if you're not an American. Okay, so that's kind of a romantic idea, but nonetheless, that is what it is. And Trump has none of this in him. There's no poetry in his view of the United States or the world. It is us against them. Everything is us against them, including anybody he likes.
I will add, and you said it, and I've said it on Twitter, that there's a big difference between a two-term president and a one-term president.
Right.
If he's a two-term president, all bets are off.
Well, obviously, if he's a one-term president, then he will be repudiated the way George H.W. Bush was repudiated, and in a funny way, in the way Jimmy Carter was repudiated, if he was in fact repudiated. However, I do think we want to say this, because I mentioned Jimmy Carter. We were having this debate. Abe said, maybe what Trump said about Kim loving his people and his people loving him back is the worst thing than
worst
any
American, public statement.
Worst public statement of any American president ever. So we thought and thought and thought. Maybe people can respond to us on Twitter if you can think of others. The only one that I could think of that seemed to me to be as egregious was when Jimmy Carter said, we are getting over our inordinate fear of communism a year before the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and many other communist depredations took place during the late 70s and through the 1980s. That's one I could think of that was pretty bad in the past.
Yeah. Nixon, of course, had horrible private statements.
Many horrible statements. Right. But, of course, yeah. The presidency, the unguarded presidents have many unguarded moments. You know, there was Reagan making a joke out of how we begin bombing in 5 minutes right before his radio cast, which was not intended to be public, went public. I don't think really it was a joke, so that's not...
If we expand beyond the presidency, I think Justice Taney's holding in Dred Scott, the things that he says about African Americans is. But that's not an elected official. He's not a president. It's a shameful moment. But that's the kind of standard we're looking at. Carter with communism, Taney with African Americans. Right.
Obama, the interesting thing about Obama is that he was always very careful to structure his most controversial statements in a way that made them like water, including, you know, on the famous apology tour that started his presidency, where everybody understood that the superstructure was that he was going around apologizing for America, but he never said, I'm sorry, you know, and it's the same way that when he gave the speech in Cairo, the disastrous speech in in Cairo, that he was not attempting to, you know, he was attempting to create a superstructure in which he said, look, I have Muslim stuff in my background, so you can trust me, and I'm winking, saying I'm not going to like Israel very much. But he never said any of that.
To connect the two things we're discussing, yeah. I think if there is one factor that you can blame for why the right in the U.S., but also in elsewhere in the world, is shifting in this direction. If there's one thing you can, I find sort of most directly contributed to it, it's precisely that way of speaking of Obama's that I think I've said this before on this podcast. It drove people insane. This sort of speaking above you, beyond you in some way, and it gave the sense that the president of the United States was not an actor on the world stage acting for Americans, as though he was a sort of an enlightened observer commenting on world affairs. I think so you ask why things are going the way they are, you know, in commentary in our 2016 issue, I think October, or I can't remember exactly when. I do blame mainly the sort of the generation of center right and center left leaders that immediately preceded the Trump era, especially Obama, but then Merkel, Hollande in France, Cameron to some extent, for bringing this on. They're security failures, and again, if you can pinpointed even more starkly the day of the Bataclan attack in Paris, and Obama saying our ISIS strategy is working and nothing, you know, I'm not going to concede an inch as to what to do. People begin to think, well, what's the point of this world order if it can't keep people safe or going to a concert in Paris? That doesn't. It's not normatively to say that what we're getting now in the form of Trump is any good. I have huge issues with it, not least with what we saw in North Korea. But you could see where the cracks began to appear in the system.
Oh yeah, I mean, look, the system cracked in various ways. The United States went to war triumphantly in Iraq, defeated the regime in 3 weeks, and then got mired in a conflict that took almost seven more years to get to a point of, you know, I think relatively okay resolution, in fact, as we sit here, but nonetheless, looked bad. That cracked us open. We kept having to go back into Afghanistan to win the same territory that we were unable to secure and to try to defeat the Taliban that we kept saying we're defeated and then weren't defeated. And then, of course, you had the financial meltdown of 2008, which really cracked open the sense that, you know, the world's systems were not being run for the benefit of most people, but that the ordinary guy was getting screwed by the rich guys and by the system.
Yeah.
And all of that, I think, played out for various complicated reasons in the 2016 election, and you have to understand that. I think we all do understand that Trump taps it. I think this is partially what Noah's saying, taps into a deep reservoir of American feeling. And we're now supposed to accept that all feelings are somehow equal because they're felt. But of course, there are good ideas and bad ideas. And that's where we get to the question of what happened in between Trump and Kim, which is that a whole host of bad ideas were laid out almost systematically, even though that was not the, which is, it's good to shake hands with the devil somehow. It's okay. That doesn't that doesn't corrupt you at all, and it doesn't mean that you will bear no responsibility for the consequences because you don't want them. So that's nice.
And the anger of the Trumpians at any criticism of his what I think North Korea debacle is especially, I mean, from my point of view, because like Abe, you know, I think I've gone out of my way to be fair to the administration, even fair to the president. And defend him against that kind of smug consensus where it's like everyone knows that what just Trump did, whether it's the Iran deal or anything else he's done, or Paris climate agreement pullout, all of it is bad. It's just automatically bad because Trump is at the source of all of them. I've sort of tried to resist that and say, hey, hold on a second, especially from some conservative critics. You've been calling for XYZ. Now you're angry that Trump did it. But the minute you criticize Trump, then these minions are sort of like, oh, there you go, you liberal, neocon, elite, cuck.
It's worse. I think it's even worse than that, because one of the most repulsive offshoots of the debate over the Iran deal, as you may remember, was this notion that if you were opposed to the Iran deal, you were a supporter of war. And so there was no, you know, that was it. And so what do you want? War? Fine. You warmonger, all you want is war. You love war. You drink war. You know, it's your life's blood. Right? So this is a way of just trying to shut people up and argue in bad faith, and it's really awful. And the weird thing is that this was happening the other day on the right with, if you uttered a word of criticism, it was like, "Well, you don't want peace?" You obviously think that nuclear war, it's better. Trump is coming bringing peace and you're for war.
Well, you know, also I think...
this is what we get. And by the way, from some of the same people who hated the Iran deal. The hypocrisy that was laid out by on the part of a lot of people, including like Mercedes Schlapp, who is Trump's communications director of some sort, who like had a whole series of tweets about how, what's Obama going to do now after he shook Castro's hand? He's going to go shake Kim Jong-un's hand?
But
he's Obama, terrible, dictator, sucker-upper, and now there she is working for, you know, the man who said that Kim was wonderful.
But I mean, I think it's also important to address the fact, and Noah can lay this out as he did earlier, that even in terms of the potential for war, what happened yesterday is in the long run provocative in some sense, or could turn out to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose so, insofar as the belief is that as long as we're talking, we're farther away from conflict, which is true. As long as there are lines of communication open, we're farther away from conflict. But that's a short-term proposition. Right. In the long term, I suspect we've gotten closer, because one of the things that everybody was agreed upon before Donald Trump did a 180 and decided that he was going to play peacemaker was that time was not on our side, is that stalling for time was what DPRK and PRC wanted. And what we needed to do was act quickly and decisively and before the threat metastasizes, before they develop a sophisticated long-range missile and a reliable reentry vehicle, at which point we'd have a gun to our heads and couldn't be racked. So the belief now is that this program is frozen, but we don't know that. Mm-hmm. And the extent to which the regime has managed to secure itself, ensure its survival, preserve its nuclear program, and buy time gets us closer to conflict, not farther away from it. And that is why people are... And then they say that you're just a warmonger. Precise opposite. This is what we're trying to avoid. It is the appeasement approach.
Right.
That is the danger. One quick thing just to respond to John's point earlier about the nature of this, the permanence of the Trump phenomenon. I suspect that because there are no ideological moorings, no policy preferences that transcend Trump the man and the insults and the extent to which that is what people know about Trumpism, I don't suspect that will survive Trump. I do think that the lowered expectations around his presidency are going to be impossible to reverse. When Trump says war games, you have to have a relative amount of sophistication to know that you're not supposed to legitimize DPRK propaganda. You have to know that. You have to know it is DPRK propaganda. If you just think, well, that's what people in the bar say, and he's talking like a regular person, what's the harm in that? Then you just are embracing ignorance. You're not even interested in an explanation from somebody who knows what they're talking about as to why that's dangerous. And I think that's really tempting for a lot of people to just shut their brain off and just think like a populist, because you don't need any background knowledge to think like a populist. You can think with your gut. And I think that's dangerous, and I don't think it's going to be reversible.
I would sort of close out by saying that it is not clear to me from Trump's own conduct, his behavior, the way he speaks, the private jokes that he seems to tell himself, that he believes that his words have any weight, or that anything that he says is not reversible later, simply by the fact that he can reverse them. And, you know, we are asserting that that is not the case with a powerful person, that that there are reverberations from things he says and things he does that can last for decades. This is the sort of thing that led, famously, people like Eisenhower and Reagan to be tongue-twisted when they talked about foreign, often in certain ways, although Eisenhower, the claim is that Eisenhower did this consciously, but because there was so much they knew that they couldn't say, and they wanted to answer questions or say things, but that there were, they had, it would be made clear to them, or they understood that, you know, using X word or Y phrase or Z idea could lead to, you know, intelligence services in some country saying that X, Y, and Z was going to happen, and there could be a coup there, you know, because America is so powerful and so big and so meaningful. Trump kind of relies on the fact that nothing that he says is necessarily should be viewed as having any intrinsic meaning. And I think a lot of people in America have already gotten to that point of thinking that, or certainly among his supporters, that it only has meaning when he says it. If he announces that what he said is no longer operative, that's fine with them. You know, it's like, but I'm not sure that that's, it would be very dangerous for people to think that the rest of the world operates under those terms. What Trump says, how he acts, how he behaves, is now the subject of the foreign ministries of entire countries and intelligence services of entire countries parsing it. It's like they are like new critics with a difficult poem. This is how they're going to live their lives, and they will come up with theories that Trump, that cannot bear the weight, because it is just brain farts often. And he didn't mean that Kim's people loved him. I mean, he did. Next day he could say they hate him. What does he know? If Kim says something nasty about him, he'll say his people hate him.
You know, like that. I mean, for the people who are just Trump curious, or responsible Republicans and conservatives, or, you know, anybody with an ounce of self-respect left, will say that we don't know what the result of this is going to be. And they're not exactly saying that this is peace in our time. That's crazy talk. That's propaganda. They're saying, wait and see. We don't know. We don't know what the next steps are going to be. There are going to be follow-on negotiations. They might ink something that's a little bit more permanent with a verification regime. Wait and see. And that just tells you the extent to which this, what happened on Monday, was indefensible. There is no defense for it. They are waiting for events to rescue them. And after having just come off a really tough battle with conventional wisdom, with media, with Democrats, with the rest of the world about the virtue of abrogating the Iran deal, the terms of this agreement are very difficult to defend. And I think that's a burden on the shoulders of a lot of Trump supporters that are going to be find very hard to shoulder, I think. I mean, the extent to which hypocrisy is an obstacle, you know, is debatable. It's usually not. But for people who have some
obstacle.
Integrity,
it used to be an obstacle.
It's going to be a very tough haul.
Right. It used to be an obstacle, but that is one of the many ways in which our public discourse, people, you know, hypocrisy is the tribute that vice pays to virtue. The tribute is not really paid much anymore, let's say, because people no longer fear being accused of hypocrisy. It's just whatever they say is no longer operative and has been superseded, shall we say. And with that, I wish you a wonderful weekend. And I can't wish you one. It's Wednesday. We did this a day early. It's wrong to wish you one. I wish you a wonderful Thursday and Friday. And I think so does Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman and Saurabh Amari. And that should have been due. Not does. So do Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Saurabh Amari. And for them, keep the candle burning.